And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, the clown show continues with Nancy Pelosi wanting to limit the president's power to declare war. Apparently, only she should have that power. Well, continuing with our topics, last night I talked about UFOs and the moon and what have you. We're going to continue talking about that. Apparently, it isn't just the average individual who talks about aliens or entities pretending to be aliens, having established bases on the moon and Mars. In fact, there'd been discussions all the way up to the top echelon of the United Nations. In support of the idea that contact with Mars goes higher than the average individual, there is a story of a United Nations diplomat named Farida Iskiavet, who in February 1972 investigated UFOs and occupant contacts for the President of the General Assembly. According to her, she'd been contacted by a spacecraft that the occupants said they were from Mars. The contact took place in the Mojave Desert in California in 1971, and it made the front page of the Arizona Republic. It was also reported in the San Clemente Sun Post by a reporter named Fred Swiggles. Now, according to Iskiavet, the alien offered to admit an ambassador to their interplanetary confederation in the solar system in exchange for an alien ambassador to the General Assembly of the United Nations. It was an attempt to reestablish diplomatic relations with Earth and other planets that had been suspended in ancient times due to hostility. But apparently the terms of this arrangement weren't acceptable to the Security Council, and the exchange was rejected in a secret meeting. The president of the UN at the time, whose name was Adam Malik, was in favor of the treaty and frustrated by UN attempts to block the exchange, so he and Iskiavet contacted certain people to try to establish a civilian council to mediate between the Earth and the Interplanetary Confederacy. The corporate and military government interests that finance and control the UN didn't accept the aliens' insistence on us destroying all our weapons, and depending on their good faith promises to make sure that there were no wars. And some of the history of belief in life on Mars involves famed astronomers like Christopher Lovell, who reported huge areas of green vegetation that expanded and contracted with the melting of the ice caps and the four seasons on Mars. In the 50s, teachers in public schools in America taught students that the temperature at the Mars equator was about 80 degrees. And Marconi published data that he believed he'd received intelligent radio signals from the planet Mars. For over 30 years, several astronomers in different parts of the world reported seeing flashes and moving lights on the surface of Mars. Also, signs that there were huge explosions and other strange, unnatural phenomena. 1927, the U.S. government carried out a public experiment designed to try to detect intelligent life on Mars by sending radio signals toward that planet and waiting for an answer. Now, was there an answer? Well, a series of dots and dashes was revealed on a machine capable of getting Morse code, reportedly originating from the direction of Mars and a drawing of a human face on a piece of receiving paper in dots and dashes. The drawing in Morse code was displayed in the Bureau of Standards in Washington, D.C. 1976, the Viking probe was sent to Mars by NASA, and out of over 2,000 photos taken of the planet, Only a small fraction were ever made public. Since most of the photos, paid for with government funds, I might add, weren't released to the news media, you have to ask yourself, were they trying to hide something? One photo that was published by the U.S. Daily newspapers in 1986 shows what many researchers believe to be pyramids and a face carved into the surface of Mars. Now, studies of other Mars photos show us what appear to be an ancient ruined city, roads, rectangular buildings, and walls. Now, skeptics, of course, claim the shadows may make natural objects appear to be man-made. But all the photos were taken at different angles from the sun, and the cameras show the exact same objects the same way, which kind of discounts the shadow theory. Now, having established that Mars most likely at one time harbored intelligent life, you have to ask yourself who that life was or what it consisted of. According to certain researchers, the Martians who landed on Earth 11 to 12,000 years ago, over 100 generations slowly adapted to the lower elevations and Earth's climate as they gradually migrated to lowlands over the centuries. It's believed that Mars was involved in nuclear wars when the Orion Empire invaded our solar system in ancient times, devastating the forests and oceans and rivers and atmosphere on both Mars and Mercury, and caused the destruction of the ancient prehistoric empire of Atlantis on Earth. The nuclear devastation in Atlantean times was so great that very little trace remains today of that culture. And it's possible Mars was struck by comets more than once, which, of course, caused other cataclysms. Now, it does raise fascinating questions. You have to ask yourself, was there a civilization on Mars? Well, if you look at the few photos that we've been allowed to see, there is evidence that supports that premise. And that being the case, what happened to it? If they were more advanced than we are then, how advanced would they be now? Now, the theory is some Martians chose to move to safety inside their planet underground rather than flee to Earth. And it's believed that today an entire civilization of artificial dome-shaped protected underground cities exist, air-conditioned with controlled climate, connected by tunnels and subways all over the planet Mars. It's believed these self-sufficient underground communities grow their own food in artificial food facilities created by their superior technology. They mine the interior of the planet, and they manufacture spacecraft. Now, Mars is no longer involved in colonizing Earth or trying to substantially interfere with our affairs like they did in ancient times. At least that is the theory. According to those who profess to know, the underground civilization on Mars has no pollution, no disease, no crime, no poverty, no political corruption, no malnutrition, no warfare, and in fact, few of the problems associated with our civilization. It's been described as a technological, intellectual, scientific, computerized paradise where emotions such as pleasure and sexual ecstasy and individuality have been eliminated among the locals. Cloning is the main form of reproduction. Now, they have what the liberal left wants the human race to have. They follow their leaders in everything. Now, it is believed there are different races on Mars. And these races originate from other solar systems that are varying the levels of spiritual, technological, and intellectual evolution. And they have regular disagreements about planetary affairs. The Zeta Reticuli race of small humanoid gray aliens with large heads, the grays that have been mentioned in regard to UFOs have a thick, tough skin adaptable to the harsher atmosphere of the surface of Mars. And they're said to be a spiritual civilization on Mars that's so far advanced that the other civilizations can't interfere with it. Has very little involvement with Earth and avoids our internal affairs. Now, there is a young lady who claims to be the great-granddaughter of President Eisenhower. Of course, there's never been any DNA proof examined. And even though there's a lot of discussion about her on the internet, let's be realistic, just because you read something on somebody's blog or hear them talking about it on some broadcast doesn't prove very much in this age of cyber fabrication. Now, she claims to be President Eisenhower's great-granddaughter and says she's part of some spooky espionage program that allows her to wander about on the Martian surface as part of a shadowy secret Mars colony project. Her name is Laura Magdalena Eisenhower. First appeared as a guest on Alfred Lambremont's Weber's podcast, aired on exopoliticsradio.org. And certainly you have to take with a grain of salt what you hear on these shows. Now, good-natured but always well-informed, they only believe the aliens are here, but we should take for granted wholeheartedly there are equals and we should open our homes and hearts to them, just as the liberal left wants to do to anybody and everybody who comes to our borders. According to what Liberty writes on Examiner.com, the alleged purpose of the secret Mars colony is to provide a survival civilization for the human race on Earth in the event of a planned or natural cataclysm that might depopulate the planet. According to the ex-political chief, Ms. Eisenhower and a cohort identified as Key Leah, a Stanford-educated artist, futurist, and fashion designer, have recently found themselves part of a growing cadre of independent whistleblowers disclosing secret technology and extraterrestrial-related covert operations of U.S. military intelligence agency and corporate entities. Now, this is something that Jesse Ventura should sink his teeth into and expose to the public on his conspiracy show, which I've interviewed Jesse several times. We haven't discussed this, but quite an intelligent gentleman. Well, according to Laura Eisenhower, the surface of the moon and Mars is not as silent as we've come to assume. 3 days before leaving office, Eisenhower voiced his concern that there was a rapidly expanding evil amongst us in the form of the military-industrial complex, who endangered our very existence and threatened to actually inject itself into our educational and scientific process so as to push their own corrupt agenda upon an unsuspecting public. Now, according to the former president of the United States, the prospect of domination of nation scholars by federal employment, project allocation, and the power of money is ever-present is gravely to be regarded. And certainly a lot of the problems of civilization come directly from university educators. Laura Magdalena Eisenhower's scenario encompasses so many offbeat aspects, from time travel to the involvement of secret cabals trying to rule our destiny. It's best to let the individual tell her own story from the outset in her own words. Now, according to Laura Eisenhower, throughout her life she could visualize and feel the larger global energy field, more vast and expansive than she could handle. All global suffering affected her deeply, and she felt an overwhelming responsibility to try to restore things. The demand was in direct relation to the survival of consciousness on this planet, the survival of our own soul, and the survival of much of humanity in terms of avoiding great danger and threats. She held a very strong vision of how the world would be if she could retrieve her many aspects she felt in places other than her body. Some kind of split that was evident, but it wasn't multiple personalities, more an awareness that there was much more to her than she needed, that she needed to retrieve and wanted to feel whole in order to restore the planet. Now, she knew she was going to be led into a dark realm, but she blocked out the premonitions of how terrorizing and painful it would be. She said somehow the underworld felt like her womb, the region where her creative fires could be awakened to send their transformational love out to the world. Her relationship with men began to make more sense in her life when the Mars recruitment agenda showed up. She had been through a series of events with men throughout this soul alchemy journey, as she called it, which seemed to always have some strange relationship with aliens, and they didn't know about it. I could feel the switch go off in some of them at certain times, particularly when she was at her most vulnerable. She knew this was a lower vibrational than her other allies in the universe. Seemed clear to her that there were both false abductions, and then there were the real ones. The one she believed her great-grandfather, President Eisenhower, confronted, which had been a well-known cover-up. Her life seemed to have taken this legacy on, and though she can't say what exactly happened in the encounter that Eisenhower had, she could say that what's been the result of it, and the role that she's been given in terms of handling things related to agreements and technology and battles and bringing about peace and justice both on and off planet. The lower alien entities would lead these men to attack her and be quite out of control. Her ex-husband, she came to discover, was giving his sperm to an alien race and been abducted many times. He's very out of control with their frequencies, and it was beyond a challenge for her to handle. At night, sometimes he would say he could see them and that they were around us, and some nights he refused to even sleep. He had extreme paranoia and shifts in behavior that just happened out of the blue, and the erratic nature of his character is very unsafe and at times life-threatening for her. Sort of by accident, they came together, and it seemed too random to have been destined, and nevertheless, it showed her that something of an alien nature was affecting his body, heart, and mind deeply. Now, keep in mind, these are the words of Laura Eisenhower. She, like so many others, had a platform that allowed her to become known within the field. And not everyone who's been known within the field is, well, frankly, some of them have been a sandwich short of a picnic, in my humble opinion. The jury's still out on Laura Eisenhower, but I'm going to continue to give you her information. Deep down, we're all aware of the current global conditions, she said, and the limited ways we try to solve these problems never seem to penetrate deeply enough to end the patterns that we're all too familiar with. Felt to her really like the only way, and regardless of that, she didn't have a choice in the matter unless she was going to give herself to those other options that were not in her makeup to even consider. The only way to grasp what she was sharing is to not only have an open mind, but to look into the roots of how we heal with trauma on a deep level and to view nature as an extension of ourselves, as we're an extension of it. Embarking on an archaeological dig within could prove useful in creating change because really the treasures that are lost are in our own being. We can't see this very clearly when our minds are engaged in the dominant powers of control, even if we've grown immune to it and consider our lives content and abundant. The fact is, the rest of the world is not, and we're all responsible to one another in terms of establishing justice and having the willingness to have compassion and the clarity to see through the false matrix and the devastating effects from it that are taking place. And if we can't do it, then the outcome is a self-fulfilling prophecy, and regardless, all life returns to the great cosmic womb. No technology, spacecraft, president, or scientist can override in words or action the basic truth of what existed before the Big Bang and what's considered the mother of all souls. The Mother Energy is the activator and the illuminator of all that's been inherited from her. It's in our DNA. She's done incredible work, she said, on one level of the organism, which is the planet Earth. But without humanity joining in with this new paradigm shift, we'll continue to live in the symptoms and side effects of being blind. What's now coming to the surface and all the bliss that's really ready to fill the world will only penetrate some, and the gateway that's opening will only be seen by those who've awakened. The Anunnaki and all the dynamics related to that race reveal the roots of the goddess story and why Inanna, or Venus, goes into the realms of hell to complete the cycle again and again to merge with the Dark Sister, who lay trapped beneath the layers of control. Sacred union and Heros Gamos is also a powerful theme in all of these stories, as well as there being a differentiation between the Grail Knights, the Shepherd Kings, and Christ himself. And one time the goddess was in wholeness and there was no disease, suffering, or war, but the competition between many of the archetypes and their desire for control splintered the bonds of sacred union on Earth, which is the root of all chaos. Different necessities were birthed when the goddess became split in many aspects, originating with the slaying of Tiamat by Marduk. Alien energies that showed up in her life seemed to connect with these myths, but she had to understand it as a story in her soul that was helping her to weave herself back together. She says her work in the world now is to help people understand these concepts so that synergy and connecting of the dots can be established through all levels of education and awareness, including philosophy, creativity, science, physics, and the imagination, and the hieroglyphs and the archetypes of soul. In a sense, she said, myth does repeat itself, but like a snowball that grows and grows as we get further away from really giving it the recognition it needs, both within and outside of ourselves. Well, she said after her husband and she began to separate, she somehow accidentally arrived at a psychic institute where more than a dozen readings confirmed her past lives and present energy body. She said it would truly freak people out if she shared what they told her, so it's better to find some of these things out on her website. They said she was cosmic mind spread throughout the infinite universe. Creation emanated from her sense and emotional body. She had a hard time believing anything that she heard from them, so she just listened, but then the emotion would come up and the truth of some of what they said overwhelmed her. She was emerging and getting a clear validation. In April 2006, she decided to go to a festival. Now, she'd been a recluse dealing with extreme emotions because she could feel the forces of the Archons and the negative technologies try to break her on a daily basis. All she could do, she said, was cry and scream in absolute refusal, letting any mind control waves into her being. And Kalia, and she spoke at great length, and she empowered what she saw on her, which was the matrix of Kuan Yin and Isis. But at this festival, she met a man who she began to call Agent X. They just hit it off and spent the evening together, and she was really falling for him big time. She could feel their connection in past lives and was just amazed. He admitted he was falling fast and was the sweetest thing ever, and they discussed many things relating to Magdalene and Arimathea and how he had heard that their paths would cross, and no mention of his Mars mission, which was to come later. He seemed to embody Joseph of Arimathea and Osiris in every way, and his knowledge of nature, his artwork, and awareness were deep and intense and quite brilliant. June of 06, they got engaged after some time. After they fully had a heart connection, it was undeniable. As she got to know him, he started to reveal things to her about the group he goes to, who are quite psychic and deal with alien abduction-related things. He himself had witnessed something truly bizarre with an animal that was scanned and had all the blood sucked out. The radiation or energy around this really affected his health for a long time. And regarding this group he mentioned, he believed he had joined a sort of think tank, an investigative group that was also working on creating a mission to Mars. K kept telling her the cataclysms that were coming and that this was something they were special to be involved in. Agent X, she said, very much thought that the people he was dealing with were good guys and his psychic advisor was his hero because of the zero-point energy and remote viewing stuff he was involved in. He tried to get her involved, saying that they had a chance to escape the disaster that was coming for the planet. Just didn't sit well with her, but he wouldn't talk further, and she just hoped it would all fade away as their being together became more important. At that point in time, she had no idea the control they had over him, or that they were even using anything on him to keep him as an agent and almost a servant to their mission. Well, he revealed to her that they had a list of men who could create a more perfect union, so to speak. When you go deeper and deeper and deeper into Laura Eisenhower and her material, while she may thoroughly believe what she says, and she says she's actually traveled to Mars and walked on the surface as part of a CIA-inspired dark program, I don't think the CIA is as all-powerful as so many people think. Yes, they're involved in a lot of things, but not as many as folks seem to believe. Now, it's come to the attention of a lot of people. There's more activity on the moon and on Mars than could be explained through just abnormal atmospheric activity. There seems to be a coming and going that couldn't be accounted for by simply the NASA-based space program. There's definitely something weird and offbeat afoot, and many people have been determined to get to the bottom of it. Now, the first massive wave of UFO sightings in modern history was recorded on the west coast of the United States in 1897. That's when they had the crash at Aurora. Aircraft of unknown origins were beaming down their lights on the cities and landing and speaking with average Americans. The pilots and crew members of these odd craft gave a variety of explanations as to their origins, and they seemed to know more about us than we knew about ourselves. Now, in 1884, Nikola Tesla came to the U.S., so there's no doubt he could have assisted in the design, the liftoff and flight of these big cigar-shaped, blimp-like airborne vessels. Obviously, some sort of technology had to be applied in order for these vessels to stay afloat and to make it from coast to coast uninterrupted. And they didn't just float like a balloon. They could hover and maneuver of their own devices. They carried occupants that looked like the rest of us. They didn't seem to originate from outer space, but they could just as well have gone further than the Mississippi River and traveled on out to nearby planetary bodies. We don't know for sure what they did, but if we have a secret space program, then in fact, this may well have been a precursor to it. Now, there's a lot of evidence and people who believe we've already established colonies on the moon and on Mars. Now, I wrote a book called As Someone on the Moon, where I discuss 400 years of lights and buildings and activity being seen on the surface of the moon. And in 1958, as I've said before, U.S. military came up with a plan to establish a permanent moon base to be staffed by, I think, 16 members of the military to protect the planet. Now, history tells us astronauts have walked on the lunar surface, and NASA sent a probe to Mars that gave us what they called a scientific bird's-eye view of its surface. Now, this is all part of the official NASA U.S. government-sponsored and taxpayer-paid-for space program. But there is another space program, according to many, many people, of which we know nothing. It's a renegade program supported by elements of the secret government working hand-in-hand with what many refer to as New World Order scientists and technicians. Now, the public is not involved and is being kept in ignorance about a potentially important mission that could benefit all of us, but as usual, those who consider themselves our betters keep control and keep the bulk of the people in the dark. See, according to many, we landed on the moon and Mars a long time ago. Truth is, air travel goes back before the Wright brothers. It's rather common among members of certain secret societies. I mean, if you look at the various pyramids around the world, you'll find drawings that are easily identified with flying machines that look remarkably like our modern-day aircraft. This technology, frequently supported by huge financial contributions from the likes of International Banking Fraternal Order, been in place for more than 150 years, and well surpasses anything that's currently on the drawing boards at a recognized establishment. If we only knew what they have knowledge of, we could toss much of what we've been made to believe right out the window. And you shouldn't be surprised to learn that Nikola Tesla played an important role in the development of this unofficial space program, a program that could lead to further enslavement by our inhumane masters. It was Tesla who succeeded in the development of anti-gravity flight, stolen out from under him by Hitler and other mad power brokers, which enabled him to set up shop on the moon and Mars, according to many. Now, the modern UFO phenomenon is most often said to have begun with Kenneth Arnold in 1947, seeing flying disc over the Cascade Mountains of Washington, from which the term flying saucer was first coined. Arnold's attempt to describe what he had seen was revealing. He said they flew like a saucer would if you skipped it across the water. And that quickly became part of the everyday vernacular and set the scene for the thousands of sightings by other observers that were to follow. What's perhaps less well known is another sighting wave that preceded Arnold in the 20th century by a good number of years. Beginning in 1896, sightings of mysterious aircraft were made all across the U.S. and, in fact, in many parts of the world. And they were written up in the newspapers at the time. According to a series of books by Time Life called Mysteries of the Unknown, perhaps the most remarkable observation occurred in the United States toward the end of the 19th century. Between November of 1896 and April of 1897, the country reeled under an extraordinary series of sightings that started in the state of California, figures, and spread eastward. The wave-like nature of the phenomenon, beginning with a few observations and swelling to a peak and then eventually subsiding, was to become a regular characteristic of modern UFO sightings. It all began on a stormy afternoon in November of 1896 in Sacramento, California, about 50 miles northeast of San Francisco. A trolleyman named Charles Lusk was standing outside his house and looking up at the sky when, to his immense surprise, he saw a bright light cruising about 1,000 feet overhead. Faint shapes seemed to be moving along right behind it. Others at the nearby Capitol building glimpsed this wandering apparition, as one newspaper called it, and climbed up to the top of the rotunda for a better view. Another resident claimed to have seen not only the object, which was described as cigar-shaped, but an underslung gondola and a pair of side wheels like an old riverboat. Also saw two men on board it, pedaling furiously on something like a bicycle frame. One of them was overheard saying to the other, "We'll get to San Francisco about 12:30. Later that evening, in fact, a similar apparition was seen gliding majestically over San Francisco, flashing a searchlight on the city and sending the local SEALs scurrying off their rocks into the protected waters off the Golden Gate. Now, the report contains so much that's familiar. The commonly reported cigar-shaped craft, the way nearby animals scattered in fear, and even a couple of UFO occupants who seemed intent on reaching some kind of destination. Well, this was the first sighting in this particular flap. Over the next 2 weeks, West Coast newspapers played the story of the mysterious flying machine up for all it was worth. Where this thing would pop up next was anybody's guess. On November 24th, witnesses reported it over San Jose as well as 750 miles north at Tacoma, Washington. The next day, it was spied over Oakland and Los Angeles, 400 miles to the south. Now, the press, of course, which was much more independent in those days, was inclined to be skeptical. A headline in William Randolph Hearst's San Francisco Examiner dismissed the sightings as probably due to liquor. The Chronicle suggested that the people actually seeing was the ghost of Diogenes, the figure from Greek legend that wandered the world with a lamp in hand searching an honest man, for an honest man. Most people, though, seemed to accept the reality of this vehicle and believed it to be an airship launched by an anonymous inventor. And considering the temper of the times, it seemed a reasonable enough assumption. The United States was experiencing the first boom of a great technological era, when anything seemed possible. The electric light, the telephone, the phonograph, and other recent events were transforming American lives. Been another 7 years before the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk, but the inevitability of passenger-carrying airships was widely accepted. By the 1890s, Americans and Europeans alike were conducting well-publicized experiments with manned gliders, and U.S. Patent Office was flooded with designs for flying machines of both the dirigible and heavier-than-air types. Well, as the plot began to thicken, I guess you could say, a few more clues came to light that perhaps there was a human hand behind UFOs then and now. Jerome Clark wrote the UFO book, The Encyclopedia of the Extraterrestrial. In a section devoted to airship sightings, he wrote about a newspaper report that claimed the unidentified flying objects had a human inventor. According to Clark, the San Francisco Chronicle was headlining the claims of local attorney George Collins, who stated he represented the airship inventor, a wealthy man who'd come to California from Maine a number of years before. Now, Collins is quoted as saying, even though he later denied it, he had seen the machine, a 150-foot metal contraption with two canvas wings, 18 feet wide, and a rudder shaped like a bird's tail, built in Oroville, which was 60 miles away. It had flown over Sacramento, was now hidden in the San Francisco area while the inventor dealt with some technical problems. But soon he would fly the airship over the city a dozen times and everybody get a good look at it. Unfortunately for Collins, he was never able to back up his claims and the story faded away. But a short time later, it was reported in the Oakland Tribune that a prominent citizen, Charles Carlton, knew the name of the inventor but was pledged to secrecy. He learned it from a fellow mason who talked with the man who saw the machine as it was tested in the Oroville era. While these rumors are never verified, they did hint at a very human origin for the airships. Now, the UFO phenomenon is still more relevant information, according to the reports. There were several cases of reputed face-to-face meetings with the vessel's occupants. A Chattanooga resident talked of finding an airship on the spur of a mountain outside the city. A certain Professor Charles Davidson and his crew were making repairs to the craft and told of having sailed east from Sacramento aboard it a month before. Citizens of Harrisburg, Arkansas met the crew, which was made up of a woman, two young men, and a patriarchal inventor captain with piercing black eyes and whiskers that went down to his belly. The old man, he said, had discovered the secret of anti-gravity and planned to display the machine in public after flying it to Mars. Well, once again, we have the indication that perhaps a human source is behind the mysterious airships, and that human source may have already attained the technology necessary to take a manned spacecraft to Mars. Well, Clark reports still more encounters with human occupants. Town of Horadden, Iowa, on April 11, 1897. A 60-foot-long, cone-shaped airship with four wings passed overhead at low altitude. Witnesses heard the working of machinery and the sound of human voices and the laughter of women. About that same time in Jacksonville, Illinois, a number of reliable witnesses assert that they plainly distinguished human voices as a long, narrow, metallic craft with a searchlight flew over the town. And the occupants were seen as well. In Minnetonka, Minnesota, late evening, a cyclist observed a flying machine shaped like a boat with red and green lights on each side and a powerful light in front. Inside that craft were living people, men, women, children, moving about as if they were busy. Then another sighting of human occupants took place in Danville, Illinois. Just after midnight, an airship and a small trailer that followed it closely were observed by residents. The ships are built of some bright material, and the occupants are dressed in Western style. Lyons, Nebraska was the site of another observation. At 9:30 in the evening, an airship appeared a mile above the town. It had huge fans and propellers that the witnesses could hear. One observer who watched it through opera glasses saw a large man muffled in a great coat, apparently presiding over some kind of steering apparatus. And finally, there's the story, as related by Clark, of a rabbi's encounter with a human occupant near Beaumont, Texas. Hearing that an airship had landed at a farm 2 miles outside of town, Rabbi Levy went to check out the story. In the darkness, he could see very little except the outlines of the ship. He said it was about 150 feet long with 100-foot wings. He said he spoke to one of the men when he went into the farmer's house and shook hands with him. And he heard him say where it was built, but he can't remember the name of the place or the name of the inventor. He said they'd been traveling a great deal and were testing the machine. He said he was so dumbfounded he couldn't frame an intelligent question to ask. So there were a number of eyewitnesses to the human occupants, and those occupants discussed the fact that there was a human inventor. Well, toward the end of April 1897, the sightings kind of petered out, so to speak. As one of the oddest episodes in American history came to the end, people were just as mystified about it as they were at the beginning. Now, according to the recently revealed private notes of Emmy Award-winning television journalist and paranormal researcher Tim Swartz. He wrote the book, The Lost Journals of Nikola Tesla. This entire episode may only be the visible tip of an iceberg that involves not only a secret society, but Tesla himself. Now, Swartz is a major player on the conspiracy scene today and goes to great lengths to fill in the gaps. During the 1850s, according to Swartz, mysterious airships generally crossed the skies of Germany. And just before that, in 1848, a young German named C.A.A. Delshaw immigrated to the United States. Delshaw's own testimony put him in Sonora, a California mining town, in the 1850s. Now, where he might have been in the decades after that, nobody really knows. We do know that about the turn of the century, he married a widow and took up residence in Houston, Texas, where he lived in isolation. Had no friends, and by all accounts, his quarrelsome disposition kept everybody at a distance. Most folks dismissed him as an eccentric. He devoted hours to the compilation of a series of scrapbooks filled with clippings, drawings, and notations. Died at the age of 92. Wasn't it for a chance to discover many years later his life would frankly have gone unnoticed. 11 of those scrapbooks were discovered in a local dump by a man named Fred Washington, who described himself as a scrounger. In those scrapbooks said in Washington's furniture and antique shop, gathering dust until some University of St. Thomas students happened to find them. Two of those books were selected to be part of their display entitled The Sky's the Limit. One day in May of 1969, a ufologist named P.G. Navarro happened to stroll past the exhibit at the university located in Houston. Delshaw's scrapbooks caught his eye, and he stopped to take a closer look. Those scrapbooks contained old news stories and articles about the attempts of various inventors to construct heavier-than-air flying machines. But those were not nearly as interesting as Delshaw's drawings and notes of strange-looking, cumbersome vehicles he claimed actually had flown at one time. Navarro eventually talked to Delshaw's stepdaughter, who was an old woman at the time, and finally set out to make sense of Delshaw's notes that had been penned in English, German, and some kind of code. And when he finished, he had an unbelievable story. He said one thing was obvious. Delshaw was of two minds about what he was doing. On the one hand, he wanted his secrets known. And on the other, he seemed afraid to speak directly. So he compromised and wrote in a fashion aimed to discourage all but the most determined investigator. And even so, his writings in the main only added to the mystery. He was writing for an audience, not of his own day, but one of some future period. Swartz quoted an obscure, almost Nostradamus-like bit of poetry left behind by Delshaw. He said, "You will, Wonder Weaver, you will unriddle these writings. They're my stock of open knowledge. They'll end like all the others. With good intentions, but too weak will to assign and put to work." According to the notes, Navarro learned that in the 1850s, Delshaw and a group of associates, about 60 in number, gathered in Sonora, California, where they formed an aero club and constructed and flew heavier-than-air vehicles. Now, I have a friend who has done a lot of research into this. In fact, there's a book they came out with, Secrets of Delshaw, which I highly recommend. They worked in an open field near Columbia, a small town near Sonora. Today, there's an airstrip in the field, the only area in the predominantly hilly region where planes can take off and land safely. The club worked in secrecy, and its members weren't permitted to talk about their activities or to use the aircraft for their own purposes. One member who threatened to take his machine to the public in the hope of making a fortune died in an aerial explosion. According to Delshaw, he was the victim of murder. And there were other instances of members being disciplined for breaking the group's rules. Another, a highly educated mechanic named Gustav Freyer, was called to account by the club for withholding new information. Apparently, that this was no ordinary social group. This aero club was a branch of a larger secret society whose initials, Delshaw said, was NYMZA. Now, he said little about the society except to observe that in 1858 it was headed by George Newell in Sonora. Otherwise, he alludes to orders from unnamed superiors who were overseeing the club's activities. Now, these weren't governmental authorities. According to Delshaw, an official who somehow learned of their work once approached the club members and tried to persuade them to sell their inventions for use as weapons of war. The unnamed superiors instructed the club to refuse the offer. Now, the club had a number of aircraft at its disposal, but from Delshaw's drawings, it's hard to believe that anything resembling these machines could ever have been flown. The heavy body of the machine seems to be radically out of proportion to the gas bag or balloon that was supposed to lift it. Considering the large amount of gas that's required to lift one of today's dirigibles, even a small blimp, it's inconceivable that the small quantity of gas used in Delshell's airship would be sufficient to take it off the ground. But Swartz had a point that kept the story afloat. According to Delshell, it wasn't an ordinary gas. It was a substance called NB that had the capacity to negate weight. Now, incredible as it might seem, it would appear he's talking about anti-gravity. Still, Delshaw's notes have a curiously pessimistic tone. One strange paragraph reads, "We're all together in our graves. We get together in my house. We eat and drink and are joyful. We do mental work, but everybody is forlorn as they feel they're fighting a losing battle. But little likelihood is there that fate will bring forth the right man." And to further lay the groundwork for the revelations to be made, it's now necessary to provide some information about the involvement of the Nazis in their wartime technology, much of which was revealed only after the war had been won and the Germans vanquished. Did Nazi scientists develop flying saucers of their own? Did the technology that drove the airship flap discussed earlier progress to the point where heavier-than-air UFOs took to the skies with also human inventors as their secret source? Well, these kinds of questions still elude any kind of definitive proof, but there is more educated speculation now available that we can look at. For instance, according to the legendary Commander X, who's given his support to this particular write-up by contributing material from his personal files, he wrote an article that appeared in a special edition of UFO Universe magazine, Conspiracies and Cover-Ups, where he addressed these questions and provided at least partial answers to the mysteries they imply. According to Commander X, Nazi Germany's secret advanced weapon and space program began in the early 40s, involved the development of the Flugelrod, or wing wheel. Now, the Flugelrod was a saucer helicopter, the first vertical takeoff flying vehicle developed by the Nazis. The wings, or blades, that issued from the center of the craft had spokes like the outer rim, and they were tillable. This was allegedly the Model T of a series of German disc or saucer designs that followed. Much of this program, of course, was top secret even to the German public. According to Samizdat Publications, an ultra-right-wing organization based in Toronto, Canada, the Nazis did indeed develop such a flying device. Well, according to Commander X, why did the world not learn about this when the Nazi Germany fell? Well, according to Samizdat and others, as the war was ending, several colonies of German scientists were transported to secret bases in Antarctica and elsewhere. Possibility, when considered, seems to be plausible, where the secret disc technology was perfected. And due to the lack of verifiable proof of such an operation taking place, it's hard to confirm, but certainly when Operation High Jump, led by Admiral Richard Byrd, went to Antarctica, supposedly they had interactions with the secret Nazi bases that resulted in the defeat of a heavily armed task force under Byrd's command. Now, Commander X also addressed the Nazi devotion to the occult and quotes a researcher who went by the pseudonym of Jason Bishop, who I knew. All the Nazi-related groups are more or less closely associated with the powerful and well-organized Theosophical Society, which adds to neo-pagan magic, an oriental setting, and a Hindu terminology. Or it provided a link between certain oriental Satanism and the West. Nazi occultism was a mixture of influences and a host of interrelated secret societies, including the Bavarian Illuminati, the Knights Templar, the Teutonic Knights, the Holy Velm, the Golden Dawn, the Rosy Cross, the Viril Society, the German Order, and its offshoot, the Thule Society. This was a neo-Gnostic racist group, he went on, which became a rallying front for the secret society roots of Nazism. The chief architect was Baron Rudolf von Sebottendorf, who had direct contact with the Dervish orders, knew a great deal about Islamic mysticism, particularly Sufism in all its aspects. There's a Sibbottendorf wrote a book called Before Hitler Came that listed the occult affiliations of the Nazi leadership. But the Nazis suppressed and destroyed the book, having determined the information should be kept away from the German public. There are also others whose occult involvement could be nailed down as fact. For instance, according to Bishop, the Thuelist Dietrich Eckhart is believed to have initiated Hitler into various occult mysteries with the aid of psychedelic drugs. The most prominent member of the Vril Society was Karl Haushofer, close confidant of Hitler, Hess and Rosenberg. Alfred Rosenberg and Adolf Hitler himself belonged to the Thule Gesellschaft, as did Rudolf Hess. One of the scientists involved with the early Nazi saucer projects was, of course, Victor Schauberger, who was brought to America after the war, where he was rumored to be working on a top-secret flying disc project in Texas for the U.S. government until he died in 1958. Said that some of the prototypes, what the government's now developing, are as advanced over the Schauberg models as a space shuttle is over a biplane. Samizdat relates some information on Schauberger, which might have been considered the aeronautical Einstein of his time, although not nearly as well known as Einstein himself was. Then you have a list of, a step-by-step progression of the Nazi attempts to develop a disc-shaped aircraft. It was the Model ICT, the most conventional design. Used a standard German Walther rocket engine, was steered by a conventional rudder. Model 2C, an improvement over Model 1, with a radical departure. Specially designed rotary wing, stabilized and steered the craft. More maneuverable and faster. Then there was Model 3C. Extremely fast, using a jet vacuum propulsion system. Capable of attaining speeds of over 6,000 kilometers an hour. Then there's successors of Model 3, still in the planning stages in the mid-40s, utilize the Earth's magnetic field in their propulsion system. The Schauberger models, using the original implosion-powered propulsion system, made no sound. They were flameless and smokeless, but the outer skin of the hull, composed of a secret alloy called impervium, pulsated with various colors as the craft sped through the sky. Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. I'll be back tomorrow night, and I'll continue talking about the secret space program. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.